Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, as we talked about last episode, the end of World War II through the 1940s brought us to 1950, where the world was fully immersed in what we now call the Cold War. How did this Cold War affect Navy thinking, planning, and deployments in the early part of the decade?
Well, it absolutely dominated Navy planning, certainly, and almost entirely Navy thinking as well. It's important to remember that the drawdown in 1945, while dramatic, I mean, it had to be dramatic because the Navy had grown to such an unprecedented size in 1945. I think it's worthwhile to recall that when the war came to an end, the United States Navy carried on its list 120 battleships and cruisers, 120. And if you count the escort carriers as well as the fleet carriers, more than 100 carriers. So clearly there's a significant drawdown, but that drawdown was much less than in, for example, the years after the Civil War or even after the First World War. And the reason is the Cold War. The emergence of the Soviet Union as a clear rival, particularly in Eastern Europe, but by extension throughout the world, meant that Navy planners and Navy thinkers could not lapse into a, well, let's think long-term about possible confrontations down the road. They had to think about how could we respond to a crisis right now. And the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, combined with the rivalry with the Soviet Union, meant that Navy forces not only remained somewhat larger than they might have otherwise, they were also active. They were deployed more frequently. They were forward deployed, if that's a term we can use, into the areas of the Eastern Atlantic and the Western Pacific so that the Soviet ambitions, and of course with the so-called fall of China, that is the conquest of Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist armies by the communist forces, it seemed that communism was on the march and we had to pay close attention and keep our powder dry for a future confrontations with the Soviet Navy. And I recall it personally that in the 1950s how dominant public concern was, not just official concern, but public concern about the ambitions of the Soviets in particular. So I would say the impact of the Cold War was the driving force behind most Navy policy planning in the 1950s.
And, of course, the major war of the 1950s was in Korea. What was the Navy's role in this conflict?
Well, it was pretty significant. I mean, Korea was an important milestone. You know, for 5 or 6 years, we had been concerned that the so-called Cold War would be an economic and political, almost a philosophical confrontation with the Soviet Union. But here comes a clear-cut, cross-border military invasion of South Korea by North Korea. The North Koreans had decided that somehow the United States would not fight for South Korea, that it was outside America's area of interest. The Soviet Union agreed to hold their coat, provided them with the military assets necessary, and across the 38th parallel in June 1950 comes this invasion. Well, now this is clearly a test. How will the United States respond? And the United States Navy in particular was significant. And I'm going to mention several ways. One is that without the Navy, forward deployed in Japan at that time, it would have been impossible to maintain the supply lines from Japan to Busan, the port on the tip of Korea, where South Korean and American forces fell back to in response to this onslaught from North Korea, the so-called Busan perimeter, this enclave of Allied control in the Korean Peninsula. Absent the Navy's ability to maintain the logistic support of that position, of that enclave, it's conceivable that South Koreans and their American allies would have been driven from the peninsula entirely. So that's one. Second, and this is the one most people remember, and that is the Navy's support of the U.S. Marine Corps landing at Incheon. This was a high-risk maneuver, Douglas MacArthur's probably greatest moment as a military commander, making this decision that the end run around the North Korean lines in South Korea would be the most audacious one to the area closest to Seoul. And the landing at Incheon, up a very tortuous channel and past a mud flat and into a city, was different from anything the Marines had done previously in World War II or elsewhere. But the Navy made that possible. The destroyer support in the Flying Fish Channel leading up to Incheon, that was crucial. So Incheon would be the second one. And then on the other side of that coin, if you would, when things got grim after the Chinese incursion across the Yalu a year later, the evacuation of United Nations forces from Hungnam on the eastern coast of Korea was crucial. The Navy's ability to extricate those forces from an overwhelmingly superior advance by the Chinese Red Army. And finally, and this one I think we can't overlook, you know, there's an old saying that everybody uses that amateurs talk strategy, but professionals talk logistics. We are fighting this war 5,000 miles away from continental United States at the end of an extraordinarily long logistics support line. The ability of the United States Navy to maintain the logistical support to Japan as a staging area and then into Korea with all the supplies and the manpower and the ammunition and the material and the tanks and everything else necessary to sustain a war 5,000 miles away. That's an enormous logistical undertaking. We often think in 1949 what an amazing feat it was for the United States Air Force to maintain Berlin when the Soviets blockaded West Berlin with the Berlin airlift. But here is an even more daunting logistical support effort, and the Navy managed to carry that off as well. And it underscored, I think, the need for a Navy, not just in crisis moments, but long-term and pretty much all the time. I think that's the long-term effect that it had on American policy and planning.
And while we were fighting on the Korean Peninsula and after the conflict was finally at least paused with the truth, the 50s were also an era of tremendous technological development. And what were some of the new technologies developed by the Navy in the 1950s, and how well do we adjust to them?
You know, there isn't a period of American naval history or history generally where the development of technology doesn't have an impact on events. But it seems that in the 20th century, and particularly from the mid-20th century onward, that curve in technological expansion begins to slope upward rather dramatically, almost in a parabola. And that clearly becomes evident, as you suggest, in the 1950s. There are a lot of these things. Let me mention a couple. Probably the most evident is the emergence of nuclear power, not just for weaponry, but for propulsion. The Nautilus, the first nuclear-powered submarine, was launched and underway in mid-decade in 1955. That created all sorts of new possibilities, the ability for a submarine to remain submerged for extended periods, and the combination of that with the first submarine-launched missile, the Polaris, in 1959, at the end of the decade. I think it's the George Washington that was launched in 1959, the first one to fire a Polaris while submerged. That creates an entirely new dynamic in the principal American goal of deterring Soviet aggression. The notion was that the Russians would be disinclined to charge across another border, whether it's into Korea or it's into Turkey or it's into West Germany or wherever it might be, knowing that the United States now possessed the ability for a second strike capability that would render that conventional offensive not only useless but disastrous for them. So nuclear power and submarines, and then, of course, the launching of the missiles. Carriers got bigger and more powerful, able to carry airplanes that could themselves carry nuclear weapons. You know, the great crisis of the 1940s between the Air Force and the Navy, the so-called Revolt of the Admirals back in 1949, had been about whether the Navy should be allowed to build a so-called supercarrier, 60,000-ton displacement flat-deck carrier, which they finally did in the 1950s in the Forrestal. And, of course, since then, carriers have even doubled in size from that. But I'm sure that's a topic for another conversation. And I'll mention one other piece of technology, which really doesn't come into play as a military weapon in the 1950s, but emerged in the 1950s, and that is the shock to Americans, both at the policymaking level and certainly among the public at large, in 1957, when the Soviet Union launched the first Earth satellite, the Sputnik. That was sort of the foot in the door, if you would, that indicated that the next generation of weapons would include space, as well as the surface of the sea and the air above the sea and in the waters below the sea. So the technology is expanding dramatically, almost exponentially, through the 1950s. And in the midst of the Cold War, it creates kind of an arms race environment where each side tries pretty desperately to stay ahead of the other.
Even in the decades that we have larger conflicts, we also have other roles that our Navy Marine Corps team gets involved in. Where else besides Korea did the U.S. Navy play an important role in the 1950s?
Well, as I mentioned, the forward deployment of the Navy kind of around the periphery of the Eurasian landmass, the Soviet/Chinese communist area, meant that the United States was on patrol, if you would, to defend against perceived as well as actual attempts by the communists to spread their influence to dominate the world. This was the assumption made by policymakers and political officials, was that the Soviet Union in particular and their presumed Chinese partner, we know now that partnership was rather strained, but at the time the belief was that they were in cahoots in all of this and that they would look for any weak point to expand. One of the flashpoints, clearly, then as well as now, was in the Middle East. The creation of the Sixth Fleet and the maintenance of the Sixth Fleet, usually with one or two carrier groups and their supporting vessels, was there to prevent the Soviets from taking advantage of instability in the Middle East and elsewhere. Perhaps one of the flashpoints that I think casts the character of this confrontation into rather stark shadows was the Suez Crisis in 1956. You know, the Soviets had been providing economic support and aid to Egypt's government, particularly with the construction of the Aswan Dam. That was perceived in American planning circles as an attempt by the Soviets to get another foot in the door, use the same phrase again, to influence Egyptian policy. And when the leader of Egypt decided he was going to nationalize the Suez Canal, which had been built by a British and French investment company, and simply take it over, the British and French responded by invading Egypt. Well, now, this was here's a destabilizing factor. Is this part of the Cold War? Is this a confrontation between colonial powers and post-colonial powers? What exactly is going on here? A message from the Pentagon went out to the commander of the Sixth Fleet, Admiral Brown, and told him, be prepared for hostilities. And a great message that I think suggests a lot about the difficult nuances of the Cold War era, Brown wrote back, "I'm fully prepared, but which side are we on?" And that kind of uncertainty, I think, says a lot about the fact that the Navy was on patrol and in position and ready to go, but who exactly are the good guys and the bad guys here? Similarly, just 2 years later in Lebanon, when again instability ashore suggested that an opportunity might be emerging for the Soviets to take advantage of instability, Marines actually landed on the coast south of Beirut. in 1958. That was eventually all sorted out. But these kinds of issues in the Middle East and elsewhere suggest that it was a time of great uncertainty for the Navy and for the nation, in fact.
That is a great quote that even today, oftentimes, we in the military find out that, okay, we're prepared to do something, but which direction do you want us to go in? It's amazing. Some things just do not change. And that's a great wrap-up to the 1950s. And I'm glad you mentioned the landing in Beirut. For those that like visual representations, they can do a Google search for images. There's a great picture of U.S. Marines storming ashore. With girls in bikinis in the background, back when you could actually do that.
Yeah, that's not exactly why the Marines were storming ashore, but yeah, it's a
it's an extra benefit.
Well, I've seen it.
I look forward to getting to the tumultuous 1960s with you on our next episode, Craig.
All right, thanks, Al.
Claude, at the end of our discussion of the 1940s, we talked about how the nuclear weapons had changed the way people were thinking about the future of war. But when we rolled into the 1950s, like a bucket of cold water in the face, we found ourselves in a very conventional ground combat, but also projecting power ashore on the Korean Peninsula. What do we find in the during the Korean War in the first part of the 1950s?
The Korean War operations are really focused on the Marine Corps. Interestingly enough, there weren't a lot of articles about naval operations, despite the fact that there were significant strikes being conducted by United States aircraft carriers off the coast. You had minesweepers and you had other assets in that region. So it's actually surprising that there wasn't more. But I think in part it was due to the aftermath of the Second World War, which was still on the minds of these officers and the readers of proceedings particularly. They tended to focus on the other broader issues, if you will. But getting back specifically to this new atomic age, there were articles on the prize essay, for example, in 1957 by Commander Malcolm Cagle at the time, who wrote A Philosophy for Naval Atomic Warfare, who suggested that we'd had such remarkable technological advances that the Navy could now carry and deliver precision nuclear weapons, and we had to be prepared to use them. You're right. I think there was almost a nonchalance and an acceptance that this was simply going to be a new way of conducting war. There was certainly also the impact of nuclear power on submarines. Commander Kittredge had written an article on the launching of the nuclear-powered submarine Nautilus in 1954, and the important arrival of that specific piece of a very key piece of U.S. naval operations. And with that, we also see their capability in terms of missile technology. Admiral Gallantin writes an article on the future of nuclear-powered submarines, expanding the strategically important aspect of nuclear weapons and submarines. And in our Warrior Writer exhibit, we actually have an aluminized letter that was written to Admiral Gallantin from John F. Kennedy. The date was 19 November 1963, just a week before he was assassinated. And he's basically thanking Gallantin for a few days earlier on the 16th of November. Kennedy had been on the USS Observation Island when he observed he witnessed the Polaris firing from the USS Andrew Jackson. And JFK writes to Gallantin that this weapon system was clearly a deterrent that was not debatable.
One thing in the beginning part of the Korean War was a very dismissive attitude towards China. However, our experience with the Chinese during the Korean War disabused us of that dismissal. What do we see as we started to look fresh at communist China and how that implicated our general national security environment?
Sure. Well, certainly there were a lot of articles during the Cold War, especially during the 1950s, about the Soviet Union. They were seen as our primary peer competitor at the time, Admiral Ernest Eller, who had written a number of articles, writes in 55 on the Soviet bid for the sea, among other articles. But certainly they're starting to talk about, even in the early 1950s, the threat of communist China at sea. Even Colonel J.D. Hittel, eventually rises to the rank of brigadier general, writes in 1952 of the background of Chinese action, where he said that, you know, China is seeking to reestablish herself as an East Asian dominant power. I mean, these are articles that we might see in proceedings today.
And we also found by mid-decade, you mentioned before about World War II briefly, is by mid-decade, we were close enough that the memory was still fresh and the players were still there, but a little distant away that we could start to read from our former opponents or enemies during the Second World War and to read things from their perspective. What do we start to see from Japanese and German officers?
We don't see that many from German officers. We see it primarily from Japanese officers, maybe because that was such an extraordinarily large part of the naval operations during World War II. But you have the key Japanese officers who are writing in translation for Naval Institute proceedings. In 1952, for example, Captain Mitsuo Fushida writes his firsthand account on how he led the attack on Pearl Harbor. The following year, there was another first-person account by a Japanese dive bomber commander about how he and six aircraft attacked and sank the gunship Panay in December of 1937. And there are others like that. There was, in 1955, an article called The Prelude to Midway with Fushida and Okumiya, who were two former Japanese officers involved, and gave this prime history description of the Japanese planning. So I think in the 1950s, you have this extraordinary ability to understand what the enemy was thinking during these major battles, these major strikes.
Another thing we touched on just briefly at the beginning is nuclear war. And when you look back, not just from some of the military documents, but in the popular culture, mm-hmm. the concept of global nuclear war was almost just a part of the environment. The heyday of SAC, the ballistic missile submarine development, but very real, very practical discussions of what global nuclear war would be like. Do we see a very much open scholarly work and discussion on the practical nature of conducting nuclear war?
Yeah, I think I mentioned earlier the article by Commander Malcolm Cagle, who comes closest to that. But from really a strategic view, we see other articles that aren't necessarily nuclear in nature that are very fundamental to proceedings, history, and to our own understanding. For example, Samuel P. Huntington, who's probably best known for his work on the Clash of Civilizations, writes in 1954, when he's still a very young man, I think he was 26 or 27 when he wrote an article on national policy and the transoceanic Navy. It's probably one of the most important proceedings articles ever on national policy and the Navy, discusses the defensive phase, the fleet against fleet phase, and how the Navy was projecting strategic power ashore phase. But you also see other operations that are being considered that also seem prescient in terms of how we saw this in previous decades as well. Robert McClintock in 1954, for example, who was the U.S. ambassador to China, writes on the River War in Indochina. And you have to remember that the French were involved in Indochina and we become involved in Vietnam a decade later. Maurice Dejean, who was the Commissioner General of France in Indochina, writes in proceedings in 54 on the meeting of Dien Bien Phu. So already our Navy and Marine Corps officers in 1954-55 are reading about a place that they don't realize they're going to be going to in another decade. So I think in some ways those are actually more important to the officers and to the readership during those years. And of course, there's other things that happen in the 1950s for this Commander Elmo Zumwalt, who goes on to become one of the probably the best, one of the best known chiefs of naval operation. We now have a new destroyer named after him. Writes in 1959 called "Behind the Hump," "Beyond the Hump," on the hump of officers who were commissioned in 42 to 45, who are still on active service, and how new legislation was required to deal with this. This large cadre of officers. We have the first female officer writing. Lieutenant Dorothy Small of the United States Navy Reserve in 1954 writes on catapults coming of age for, and it was remarking on a new era for carrier aviation. So I think what when we're looking at the 1950s in total, it's an extraordinarily diverse set of topics, some historical, but you know, some topical with regard to the Soviet Union and atomic weapons, but I think far more that they were forward-looking in the next two, three, four decades, not only with China, but with so many other of the other issues that they were dealing with, and particularly the Marine Corps, who were clearly after the Korean War, clearly had a foothold, had now some very long traditions, had some credible understanding of how to conduct their operations in major conflicts, and would ready them for the next operations and war.
Well, thank you, Claude. Glad to be wrapping up the 1950s, and look forward to talking to you again as we roll into the 1960s.
Thank you.